The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm the Director of Author Events here at the Free Library. I'm very pleased to welcome our guest this evening. Annette Gordon Reed first came to the library in 2008 for The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, a remarkable feat of scholarship that subsequently won both the National Book Award for Nonfiction and the Pulitzer Prize in History. Ms. Gordon Reed's other books include Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy, Vernon Can Read with Vernon Jordan, and Race on Trial, Law and Justice in American History. In addition to her career as a writer, our guest holds three appointments at Harvard University, where she is professor of law at Harvard Law School, professor of history in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, and the Carol K. Fortzheimer Professor at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. A recipient of the National Humanities Medal, as well as a MacArthur Fellowship, Professor Gordon Reed joins us this evening to tell the fascinating story of the much maligned and complex 17th President, Andrew Johnson. Please welcome Annette Gordon Reed.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here again. I love this venue. I get lots of good questions, which we will save time for at the end. This is an interesting occasion for me. This is actually the first time I've been up in front of an audience talking about Andrew Johnson. And forgive me if I say Jefferson occasionally. I had to write that when I was writing. I did a spell check to make sure that I didn't have Jefferson in there when I should have had Johnson, because the temptation was actually quite great. If somebody had told me a number of years ago, at any point in my life, that I would have written a book about Andrew Johnson, I would have told them they were crazy. It's not that I don't think he's an interesting person. He really is an interesting person, and not that I didn't know anything about him. But for most of my career as a historian, I've tried to avoid the period of Reconstruction. And it sounds strange for someone who writes about slavery, which is a difficult topic to write about, but I find it easier to deal with the 17th century and the 18th century and attitudes about race and slavery than I do dealing with Reconstruction. There's something about it that is just maddening to me. And I think what it is that it was a moment of opportunity. When I think of the people in the 17th and the 18th century who have very primitive ideas about many, many things in the world, and you know that there are just lots of things that they don't know, I can not totally forgive them, but it's not as irritating to me, exasperating to me, as a period of time when you have photographs, trains, things that are part of the modern era, and you feel closer to those people, the people in that time period. They seem more like us than someone in the 18th century or the 17th century when I'm writing about the development of slavery in Virginia or writing about Jefferson's Monticello even. So when I read about Reconstruction and this moment of hope, it makes me angry. I'm able to be detached the further back you go, but that moment, it makes me really angry when I think about what could have happened and what did not happen and how close we were, how the coast of the country was to a period of time when you really could have done something to begin the process of racial healing, the process of making America really one for everyone. So Johnson would not have been my topic of choice. I know I read about that era because I have to, but it wouldn't be something that I would never thought I would actually study it and actually write very much about it. But I got a phone call one morning from Arthur Schlesinger Jr. And telling me that I was going to be getting a letter from him and sort of talking just in general. And I did get this letter from him in which he asked me to write the biography of Andrew Johnson for the American President series, which is a very nice series of very short, concise books about American presidents. And they get people sort of Well, sometimes people who actually fit, someone like Joyce Appleby did Thomas Jefferson. Of course, she is a great Jefferson scholar. But Gary Hart did a book. George McGovern did Lincoln, I think. And so there's sort of a mix of historians and non-historians looking at these presidencies, telling the basic story, but also giving your own sort of individual spin on it. And he asked me to do this, to the Johnson book, and I guess he figured I would put my individual spin on it. I agreed to do it because Arthur asked me to do it, and I had great respect for him. I knew him from the papers of Thomas Jefferson. We were both on the advisory committee for that. And also because Paul Golub was the editor, who is also the general series editor for the series, was my editor for the book I did with Vernon Jordan. Vernon can read. So this was two friends. You know how that is when friends ask you to do things. Who asked me to do this, and I said, sure. I put aside my misgivings. I knew it's a fascinating topic. There's so much material, very, very rich, but I wondered if I would be able to sort of curb my natural feelings of antipathy about looking at this particular period in American history, and I agreed to do it. And that was many, many years ago. This book is, I have to confess, long overdue. In between saying I would do that, I wrote The Hemings as a Monticello, which took a lot of time and energy. And then I came back to this seriously and finished it. And I'm very, very glad that I did. So the first thing I had to do was to think about, how do I approach this? Now, Andrew Johnson is not known by lots of people. Not lots is known about him. But one thing people probably do know is that in almost every survey of rankings of American presidents, he is at the bottom. He's near the bottom. He's in the bottom five. Since 1997, I've participated in these surveys, and sometimes I look at the results, sometimes I don't. But he's usually in the bottom five. Buchanan is usually the worst, but he's in the bottom five. This year, this past year, when I didn't participate in the survey for the first time, I typically fill them out. I didn't this time because I was too busy. He made it to the last. You know, he was considered the worst president. I said, just in time for the book, I could say. And in some surveys, he's considered one of the worst, and this year, the worst president. And, you know, once you get down at that point, it's really splitting hairs to think about who, you know, what's the real story with that. But it's a difficult issue, because how do you sit down and write a book about somebody who's judged the worst of anything? Well, just because someone is the worst or near the worst doesn't mean that they're not important. And that's the first realization I had. This man was president at one of the most pivotal periods in American history. And there was a moment when the country could have gone one way or the other way. And he had a central role to play in that. And it came to me, it sort of hit me that it's very important to focus on the life of Andrew Johnson, because I really do believe that some of the decisions that he made during that time period affect us even today. And the choices he made, the choices he did not make, his attitude, his leadership style, all of those things help to make us who we are. And so for those reasons, you have to pay attention to him. And I say in the book that, you know, history is not just about all the people you like. You know, all the people you love and that you would love to have dinner with and spend time with or whatever. It's about people who did things that were important that help put us on the path to where we are now. And he is definitely a person who had that kind of that role. So once I made my mind to do this and understood how to approach it, it was relatively easy to sort of sit down and get to work and try to tell his story in a way that would sort of illuminate what American life is like and what it was like during the time that Andrew Johnson lived. Now, Johnson is, well, different from Jefferson in many, many ways, but the first problem is that Johnson didn't learn to write until he was in his late teens. His wife, he married early, and his wife taught him how to write. In those days, reading and writing were different. I mean, were separate, very separate things. There were many, many people who were taught to read so that they could read the Bible. But writing was not something that people thought necessarily went together. And so his parents were illiterate. Neither of his parents could write, read or write. That we know they couldn't write because there's no, I mean, we have marks. We have no record of them writing, and people said that they were illiterate. And so he didn't become literate until he was a young man. And that poses a problem because even though he learned to write, he was never very comfortable doing it. And at one point later on, he mentioned that he sort of hurt his arm. And that he sort of explained that as a reason he didn't write. But most people think it's because he was very, very self-conscious about it. And in his writing, most of his life, he was self-conscious about it. So if you look at the papers of Andrew Johnson, there are many, many more letters to Andrew Johnson than Andrew Johnson to other people. So that poses a problem for a biographer right there. We don't have his inner voice. And with Jefferson, you have 18,000 letters that he wrote over the period of his life and, you know, other kinds of documents and other things. And even though he remains an enigma to lots of people, there's still enough there to sort of craft some sense of what he's thinking, what he's feeling, and who he was. Johnson, you're at a disadvantage because we don't really have that to the same extent. And the letters we have that show when he's a young man show lots of misspellings, lots of phonetic spellings of things. And it's difficult to wrap your mind. I mean, it was for me difficult to wrap my mind around who he really was because we just don't have the kind of record that you would typically have. Not just leaving aside somebody like Jefferson, but other people who were presidents. It's just not there. So that's a big problem. And because we don't have lots of his letters and there's not, you know, a huge repository of them or him explaining what he's doing, we don't have lots of stories about him. There's another biography. The principal biographer of Andrew Johnson is a man named Hans Trefus, who unfortunately died last year. I was so hoping to be able to finish this book and to show it to him because he's the one who went out and wrote the 500-page book about Johnson, and he's covered lots of the territory. My job was to cover some of that same territory more concisely, but also to put my spin, my view of Johnson onto the picture. But what Trefus has found, people tend to repeat when they're doing sort of smaller or general biographies of Andrew Johnson. And there's not that much more. So there had to be another approach to him. And that's one of the that's where I my expertise or my study of race relations and slavery and that period, I think, comes in handy. It's interesting to think about the beginning of America and come to a point where you're focusing on a time when America falls apart and then has to be put back together again. So I'm with this, so to start out with this material that is not as voluminous as I'm typically used to, but a person who I said is very, very interesting considering where he came from. How did somebody like this go from being illiterate, a person whose parents were very, very poor, to being someone who is at the highest office in the land? So he's born in North Carolina and to parents who, as I said, were illiterate. His father died when he was three. His mother was a seamstress, and she also worked in other people as washerwoman in other people's homes. This was a thing that caused a lot of talk. People suggested later on that maybe Andrew Johnson was not the son of his father, you know, that he was illegitimate. I've gotten some criticism for mentioning this in the book, even though Hans Trefus mentions it as well. But what I tried to do, instead of just mentioning it, I wanted to talk about the context, that just to say something about how class affected the way people viewed Andrew Johnson from the very, very beginning. Because his mother worked outside the home, worked as a maid, essentially, in someone's home, people felt free to say things like that about the family. I really doubt if she had been a married woman, sort of a married, quote-unquote, respectable, middle-class woman, if those kinds of rumors would be openly spoken about during that time period. So from the very beginning, it's not that he was just poor, it's that his family was seen as really, really marginal. And there's a difference between what people would call the deserving poor, you know, the poor but striving people, and people who are seen as really marginal. She marries again. His mother remarries a man who is as poor as she. Doesn't really improve their circumstances very much. And it gets so bad that she has to apprentice her two children. So Andrew Johnson was apprenticed to a tailor when he was 10 years old. His brother was a couple of years older. He was supposed to be in the apprenticeship until he was 21. Why it would take that long to learn to become a tailor, and it didn't, because, as you will see, it didn't take him that long to become very, very good. So he's 10 years old. He's apprenticed to a tailor, and he actually runs away. He and his brother run away, and there's an ad. The language of it I reproduce in the book. You know, basically a runaway servant ad, the kind of thing you would expect to see people more familiar with runaway slaves. You know, reward everything, capture him, bring him back, and we'll pay you a reward. This is the future president of the United States. This is what happens to him. He runs away. He doesn't come back. He hikes, goes off and actually gets a job as a tailor in another person's tailor shop and becomes very, very good at his job. And actually, even as an older man, when he's a politician, a prominent politician, he makes suits for people as a gift. I mean, it's kind of cool. You think of a president who can make suits. And you know, the sort of gender thing is out the, you know, it doesn't matter because he's a tailor, right? You know, a tailor makes suits. That's sort of that can be a masculine thing to do. But that was his way of giving gifts to people. So, you know, it was a very practical, very real world experience that he had. So he starts out very, very low. And one of the things I talk about is comparing him to Lincoln, whom, you know, he unfortunately, this is about this worst business. It's really tough. Lincoln was a tough act to follow, right? I mean, on those same surveys that I talked about, he's almost always mentioned as the best. So you go from number one, you go from the best to the worst in one terrible moment at Ford's Theater. That's what you have. You go from Lincoln to Andrew Johnson. So he suffers by comparison. So that's part of it. It's not just that he had failings, which we will talk about, but he came after someone who was, you know, amazing to people, and in good ways and bads for the people who hated him, but a very towering figure to Andrew Johnson. So we have these humble origins that seem to make him, in some ways, well, it strengthened Lincoln. I mean, hardship sometimes can strengthen people in a particular way, strengthen them in empathy, strengthen them in vision, and so forth. But I think my take on Johnson is that his hard life, being looked down upon people, being thought of as trash, made him hard in lots of ways. And someone asked me, well, you would think that that kind of upbringing would make him sympathetic to black people, sympathetic to slaves. But no, the other side is what that can do is to make you look for somebody to look down on. There's got to be somebody below you. And I think he took comfort, perhaps, in saying, you know, like many poor Southern whites, you know, I may live in a shotgun shack. I may not have very much, but I'm white. And that's better than these people over there. And so if you want to maintain that, you have to make sure there's always somebody over there or under there who you can look down upon. And I think that seems to be the tack he took in life. And to the detriment, you know, his own personal demons really ended up affecting the course of history of the United States of America. While he's in the tailor shop, he's a very smart kid, smart person. He listened to men who would come to the tailor shop to read to the tailors. And this sort of think about sort of civic engagement. You know that there are people in the shop who can't read. And a man would come and read, and he would read about a book of speeches. And Johnson loved speeches. He kept the book. The guy gave him the book. He loved it so much. And over the years, anytime he needed inspiration, he would go back and read this book of speeches. So at some point, he realizes, because he gets into a debate with a person in the shop, they kind of do the equivalent of taking it outside, but verbally, they decide to invite people to watch them argue, and it becomes clear that he has a talent, and his talent is public speaking. And that also links him to Lincoln, because Lincoln was also a good speaker as well, but he was a different type of speaker. He could be very, very rough speaking. He was good. He was sarcastic and aggressive, and people hadn't really seen anything like it. And so his fame grew. People suggested that he might stand for office, which he did, and he was very, very ambitious, good businessman. You know, even though he started out poor, he made the right kinds of investments, and, you know, he actually bettered himself financially. And he went into politics, and he climbed the ladder from alderman, mayor, every single rung of the ladder, he was on it, up to the presidency. And so it's an interesting thing, interesting comment on American life that someone could start out as low as he did and go to where he went. And so even though I can be somewhat hard on him in the book, there's no question that he was an extraordinary person. I think one of the, Paul Golub, my editor, said that, and he's done all of these. He's edited all of the ones that have been done so far. And he said, all of these people are extraordinary to make it to the presidency. It's not like somebody is just, you know, sitting around one day and says, okay, you know, I'm going to the White House. There's something there. Other people see something in that person, and the person sees something in himself, so far only him, only he's in the, involved in this, that says, I should go for that position. I should be at the top. And he was like that himself. So the book describes his ascent and how he fashioned himself, tried to fashion himself after his hero, Andrew Jackson. He comes of age during the age of Jackson. He is a unionist. He is for the common man. He campaigns for the Homestead Act. There are lots of things about him that seem very, very progressive, very populist in a way. But as you know, populism has this sort of, there's a double-edged sword there. Now, lots of times populists are in favor of measures that you would think would be progressive. He was for, you know, the Homestead Act, giving poor people land. He wanted public education. He was always a champion of public education, thinking about back on his own life and how deprived he was. He wanted a better shot for people who weren't privileged. The catch was he only wanted that for whites. He was for the Homestead Act, as I said, but when Reconstruction came and there was a time to give land reform, the Republicans in Congress wanted land reform in the South to give the former enslaved people, to give them land, to give them the kind of independence that Johnson and others understood was needed. That's what land meant. If you don't work for people, you can grow your own food, you can, you know, subsist on your own plot, and you're not beholden to anyone. He wanted that for whites, but he didn't want that for blacks. So this populist part, there was the racist part of it, inhibited his thoughts about how this might be expanded to include everybody in America. So he makes his political run at thinking of himself as a champion of the common man. He, as I said, is for the Union. He had no truck whatsoever with secessionists. And he sort of alienated even before the war, he alienated people like Jefferson Davis, because of his support for the Homestead Act. The Southern grandees, planters, did not like the idea of giving poor white people land. They said, they thought it was like, they wouldn't have used the term, but they thought, this is like welfare, you know? I mean, why are you giving these people, you know, land below market rate? Why don't they go out and work for it? Or, you know, why do they deserve this? But he was all for it. And so from the beginning, their recalcitrance about this further his antipathy towards the Southern planters. So he came up making enemies all along the way. Lincoln, he gets on the ticket because Lincoln decides that he wants to signal to the South that there was a future, that the North and the South had a future together. And so it was a symbolic gesture of unity for him to pick a Southern from the border state. By then, he's from Tennessee. He'd moved to Tennessee as a young man to put them together and to say, look, even though the South isn't participating in the election, but they're saying, look, I am willing to have a Southerner on the ticket. One of these days, we can get back together again. So he ends up on the ticket. Lincoln replaces Hannibal Hamlin, who was from Maine, who didn't give him any kind of political clout. So there he is as a vice president, this person, as I said, who started out illiterate up until his early manhood, is the vice president of the United States. And people hated that. There were many, many people who said, he is not the kind of man who should be in this office. This is a disgrace. And you're reading these kinds of things, and I even managed to feel a bit sorry for him as you hear people ragging on him about this. But then at the inauguration, he's drunk. He comes to the inauguration. It was kind of fun to write. I had a lot of fun doing this. He had been ill, and in those days, I think they thought whiskey was a cure for everything. Maybe people think that now. And he drank too much whiskey, and so there's this spectacle. And I sort of, you know, it would have been amazing if something like that would have happened today. You know, you can imagine it on YouTube, on the cable TV, everything. So all of these things, people said, see, we told you, this is, you know, those kind, if you let those kind of people into those kinds of positions, this is what they're going to do. Lincoln nevertheless stood by him. People said, you should dump him. Lincoln said, no, Andy's not a drunk. That's what he said. Andy's no drunk. He'll be fine. And, of course, Lincoln was killed not long after that. And he ascends to the presidency. And people are, of course, well, I mean, mortified doesn't even describe it. The country was traumatized. People in the North were traumatized. People in the South may have been happy about it, but they were not really celebrating about it because they had just been defeated in war. And they were in no position to really gloat about something like that, even if anyone were inclined to do it. It was a traumatic, traumatic time period. And there's Johnson, who has to rise to the occasion. And during those years, during those days, immediately after Lincoln's death, he actually does rise to the occasion. All the things that, you know, people who said, you know, the performance as vice president has sort of gone away. He knows what to do ceremonially, symbolically. He really rises to the occasion. And there's a honeymoon for him for a time period until they get into Reconstruction. And this is the part of the story that sort of, when I said I tried to avoid all of this, when they begin to realize that he is not going to have any support whatsoever for the notion of black political rights, any kind of rights for the freedmen after the Civil War. He only grudgingly accepted abolition. He was a slaveholder himself. He was not a large-scale slaveholder. He didn't have a plantation, but he did have slaves. He was a supporter of slavery. He was adamant about black inferiority. He said, you know, everybody has to admit that white people are superior to blacks, but he'd say, you know, we should try to raise them up, but as we raise them up, we should raise ourselves even further so that the distance would always be the same. In other words, you know, that was his plan. And he said, this is a white man's government, and it will remain a white man's government. Now, when somebody says that out loud and says it adamantly over and over and over again, and you have a policy from the Republicans in Congress, and they're saying black votes, land reform, some sort of political life for black people, then you realize that that's the president and Congress that are loggerheads, and that's what it was all about. His vision of the South, bringing the South back into the Union, did not encompass anything about changing black people's status beyond taking them out of legal slavery. And that's where the battle was joined between him and the Republicans, and that's what eventually led to his impeachment. A person who wrote a book, one person who was a biographer of Johnson, started the book out lamenting the fact that when people write about Johnson, all they seem to care about are Reconstruction and impeachment, but mainly Reconstruction. And then he says, but you know what? There's not much else. So he'd had this grand plan to talk about all the other aspects of Andrew Johnson's presidency, but it's Reconstruction. I mean, we buy Alaska, right, during this time period. There are some problems in Mexico that we have to deal with. I mean, but those things were handled by his Secretary of State. Most of his time was spent on Reconstruction and trying to thwart the efforts of Republican members of Congress who, as I said, wanted to transform the South. He believed that the South really had not seceded. His view was that secession was illegal, and because it was illegal, they'd never left. Jefferson Davis was not really a president. There was no Confederate, you know, States of America. There was nothing. That did not exist. And because it didn't exist, once the war is over and you bring everybody back in, it's sort of like rewinding the tape, except the slavery part. and, you know, doing, take the slavery out of it, but the South goes back to exactly what it was before Fort Sumter, before there was any conflict at all. That's a tough position to think of. You had 4 million people who had been freed at this point. So what do you do with them? And there were people who realized that called for something, but he said, no, the Constitution does not allow what you're trying, what you're attempting to do. Anything, he was very much, he said, a proponent of the Constitution. He saw himself as the guardian of the Constitution, but he had what I call sort of a cafeteria-style approach to the Constitution. I mean, things that he liked were constitutional. Things that he didn't like were unconstitutional. The Constitution clearly says that Congress has the right to set rules for the governance and everything having to do with the District of Columbia. So when Congress gives black people the right to vote, he vetoes it and says it's unconstitutional. Well, that is in the Constitution. This is not even like some kind of interpretation of it. So you get a sense of what constitutionalism means to him. If I like it, it's constitutional. If I don't, it's not. So he thought that he was in the right protecting the Constitution. The Republicans thought, wait a minute, something has to change here. We have to transform the South. You can't just have people wandering around there in some status. Serfs, I don't know what he thought, what they wanted, other than that they were supposed to be under the domination of whites. And he does something that really surprises people. You remember I said he hated the Southern grandees, the plantation owners, and wanted to punish them. He thought that they had led the South into war. He had this strange notion that Southern planters, the large-scale planters and slaves, were in a conspiracy against poor white people. And so he blamed them for the war, that the blacks and the enslaved people and their masters, they were in league trying to keep poor whites down. And he, at first he talked about punishing these people, but then he realized my greater enemy is not those Southern people, those Southern planters, rich aristocrats. My enemies are the people in the North, the Republicans, who want to change the South. And what he opted to do instead of punishing them was to put them back in power. And so not only does he try to thwart the radical Republicans, called the so-called radical Republicans, he puts all of the people who had been in, and he helps to put back into power all of the people who had been in power before the war, the very people whom he called traitors and said he wanted to punish them. He brought them back on lenient terms. He didn't require, I mean, the sort of oaths that people had to swear to, he dispensed with those. The oaths that were said that they had never, sort of loyalty oaths, he dispensed with a lot of those. And he put them back into power. Finally, the Republicans get angry about this, and they impeach him, which was and remains a very drastic remedy, according to most Americans. They see it as a drastic remedy. We've only done this twice in our history, to try to remove a president from office. He survives a conviction in the Senate by one vote. People think that really, we could talk a little bit about this in the question and answer period, but people felt that he only had maybe a year or so more to go on his term, and he would have been out anyway. The second thing was that the person who would have taken over from him, Ben Wade, was considered to be a wild-eyed radical. He believed in things like women voting, which, of course, made him like, you know, a Martian, like he was from Mars. And so what would have come after him and the fact that he didn't have very long to go on his term and some other things, he actually made some deals with people about this. They voted he escaped conviction by one vote. He is nevertheless sort of a ruined president after that. He keeps vetoing bills. He's overridden. He has hopes of making a comeback. What his real plan was to unite conservatives in the North and the South to create another political party to try to take the country back. That was his sort of idea, that it had gotten away from him, and he needed groups of the most conservative people, wherever they lived, regardless of party, to sort of band together and take back the country. It didn't work. He leaves office. He can't get the nomination. The Democrats at this time, they're not Democrats, as you know, like now. The parties have sort of flipped from where they were. They didn't trust him, and the Republicans surely weren't going to have him. So he goes back to Tennessee and begins to plot his vindication. He runs for office. He's unsuccessful at first, but he then is returned to the Senate. And he sees this as the vindication that he was right all along. He goes back up into a body that had tried to kick him out, and he's there only for a few months, and he dies in 1875 of a stroke on a trip back to Tennessee. So it's an amazing story of a person who is, as I said, enigmatic and probably, well, will be forever closed to us in some really, really significant ways just because he didn't write. We don't have his voice very much. There's some question about his formal papers, how many of those things were probably prepared by other people, but we certainly don't have the kind of day-to-day statements about his statements from him, few anecdotes from family about him. The Andrew Johnson Homestead has a website that has information about him as a slaveholder, but not huge reams of material about this person who, I think, as I said, has had one of the most significant effects on American life of anybody during American history, even though he's adjudged as a worst president. Thurgood Marshall, in one of his opinions, one of his dissents, I believe it was, maybe it was in Bakke, I think he wrote, wasn't sure it was Bakke, but he said that, you know, if America had done what it was supposed to have done during this time period, he doesn't cite Andrew Johnson, but he talks about this Reconstruction period as a point of sort of lost opportunity. And I think that you cannot blame one person for all the good that happens or all the bad that happens. But a president, and this is my approach in the book, a president is the leader of the country, is a symbolic leader. People in times of crisis, people don't look to the Supreme Court or the Congress. There's too many of them. The president is the energy of the government, and the president exercises actual leadership and symbolic leadership. And the kind of leadership that he exhibited during this time period wasn't enough to make, he didn't ruin everything all by himself, but he made it much more difficult for the right thing to be done. And that's the real tragedy, I think, of his presidency. But again, that's why I think more people should know about Andrew Johnson, because I really do believe that he's helped to make us who we are today. I mean, think about land reform. Think about the difference in wealth, the production of wealth in the black community if former slaves had land, most of them, instead of being sharecroppers. The difference between owning your own property and renting it from someone else. Now, people say, yes, but we got something good out of it. We got the 14th Amendment because his recalcitrance about all the laws that Congress was passing, the Civil Rights Bill, all those things, forced them into passing the 14th Amendment. And that's a good thing, but think about the lost, all the losses. If he had not opposed land reform, if he had not opposed black political rights, if blacks had been exercising political rights from the 1860s or have had land from the 1860s as opposed to what happened, he set us back, set the country back, and has set black people back tremendously because of the failure of his leadership, or I should say, he wouldn't say it was a failure, but from the way he exercised his leadership. He said that he wanted to preserve the country as a white man's government, and he was actually able to do that for the longest period of time. And in historical circles, up until the Civil Rights Movement, he was seen by many as a good president. If you read the so-called Dunning School, is a school of historians out of Columbia and other places who championed Johnson as a hero, who helped stave off Negro rule, you know, worthless Negro rule in the South, I mean, essentially. That historical school existed into the 20th century. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote a book called Black Reconstruction, and he just set the, as he was wont to do, set the record straight very, very clearly. And there are other people who, and once he did that, other people began to take a look, second look at Reconstruction. The people who were congresspeople, you know, they may, if you see Birth of the Nation, you know, they got blacks in Congress. They're sitting there eating chicken and, you know, and bare feet and all of these. These are some of the most educated people. These were really, really educated men, talented people who were in these offices. And it's that whole Birth of a Nation, Dunning School business really propped up Andrew Johnson because it made it look like what his attitudes were the correct ones. After Du Bois and others, certainly by the Civil Rights Movement, people began to take a different look at Reconstruction and understood that he was more of a problem than any kind of solution. So I'm glad, I have to say, even though it took me a long time to do it, and it's difficult to write about someone who, you know, you can kind of hold responsible for lots of bad things that happen, and you have to try to have enough detachment to be able to present his good points as well as his bad points, and I hope I've managed to do that. But I do think I make very strongly the case that he is a figure that we cannot ignore, that he was just there at too important a time period for him to be unknown to most people, because I think we can explain a lot about who we are by looking at his life and looking at, you know, the kinds of things that he did during Reconstruction. Actually, the trajectory of his life is a very, very American story in good ways and in bad ways. So with that, I'd like to take your questions.
Thank you very much. We've got hands already. Fantastic. Right here in the fifth row.
Do you see any parallels between the Take Back the Country movement at Andrew Johnson's time and the Tea Party and Sarah Palin?
Well, you know, parallels in the sense that Americans revere the Constitution, and some people say too much. You know, that it's almost like a sacred text. And any time we are in trouble or any time we want to make a point, we use the Constitution and say we want to get back to that document. Because that even people on the left, I mean, not as much as I think they should, but people on the left look to the Constitution as a protector. I think it's different because... It's different in this sense. There had just been a war that, I mean, you know, almost, you know, 500,000 people died, both regions, certainly the South decimated. These people, this was really life during wartime. This is not life during wartime, that kind of wartime. We got wars going on overseas, but this is hyperbole, I think, at this point, taking a country back. The country hasn't gone anywhere. You know what I mean? It's like these people are in a real... They took up arms against one another and fought one another. And those were really serious life and death kinds of issues. I think that this is, they're using that rhetoric, but it's not, to my mind, as serious as the time period that those people were in. It's more, it's rhetoric. It's sloganeering. I mean, I'm not saying that people don't have legitimate concerns and they're not serious about them, but this was, I mean, when Johnson, we're talking about life and death. Certainly in the South. If you read, Eric Foner wrote the big book on Reconstruction, and I relied on that in pointing me to some materials about some of the things that were going on. I mean, you know, this guy talked about going to a village in Texas, a town in Texas, and seeing 28 bodies hanging from trees, men, women, and little children, blacks, just, you know, the rivers with bodies floating down. I mean, this was, you know, after the war is over, and when people turned on blacks and tried to reassert their control, they were playing for keeps back then. I don't know what this is. I mean, it doesn't compare to that, I don't think, even though they might think it does.
Another question right here in the fifth row, fourth row.
Thank you for coming to the Free Library of Philadelphia and for your excellent talk. Could you talk a bit about education? I've never quite understood why the radical Republicans didn't press and push much more resources into providing education for the free slaves?
Well, they did through the Freedmen's Bureau. They tried to do that. The Freedmen's Bureau, there are really poignant stories about people, little kids sitting next to grown people, you know, everybody trying to read. That's what they tried to do, but those schools were attacked. Knight Riders, people who tried to be teachers in them, there was a lot of a backlash because they didn't want people, the folks who, they didn't want blacks in schools, they wanted them in the fields. And so they definitely tried to do that. The Freedmen, the schools, Howard, I mean, higher education, Howard University was started by, you know, General Howard, and they tried to do that, but in lots of these little places, they were not in control of all of this. And certainly once the military leaves, you know, education becomes really, really, really sketchy, even more sketchy for blacks during that time period. So they tried, but there was lots of opposition and violent opposition in many, many places.
Lady on our left in the third row.
When did Johnson free his slaves, or did he free them?
They, after the end of the war, they become free then. Not before then. I think he may have freed a couple before then, but not until after this.
Rainier?
What do you think about Johnson's argument that secession was void ab initio? And
well, you know, Lincoln said that, too, that it's illegal, that secession was illegal. And the reason he said it was because if secession is illegal, then the president exercises his power under the powers to quell rebellions and so forth. If secession is illegal and legal and they left, then you could say they're like territories, and Congress rules the territories. So it's a, as a matter of a political, of the separation of powers, it was a political, political argument. But again, Lincoln died, so we don't know what he would have done. Of what he really thought. But for him, it was, he said that was an abstraction. It was a pernicious abstraction. Johnson took it very, very much to heart. He was very literal-minded on that. Now, what I think is that, well, part of, I mean, if they thought they could leave, they left. I mean, Jefferson Davis did set up a government. I mean, you can't, it's hard for me to pretend that they were not real. That what they had wasn't a real thing. And I think Congress, they should have been governed as territories, and I think they should have kept the military rule over them a lot longer than they did to actually reconstruct them. So I understand the legal argument about it, but realistically, they set up their own government, and they stopped participating, and they went their own separate way for a time period.
Yeah, right here in the third row.
What was basically the base of support there was for Johnson? After all, he was to be regarded as a traitor to, by the Southern diehards, mm-hmm. and an unreliable president by the Northern abolitionists.
Well, before, you know, you mean what, while he's president? While he's president, he didn't have that much support. I mean, you know, he gets to be president because Lincoln gets killed. And at this point, he wants to try to make a base of these conservatives that I talked about by being lenient with the former Southern planters. I mean, they were still planters. But he tried to butter them up by not punishing them the way he originally said he was going to do. He wanted to build this party, and he wasn't really successful at doing it. Public opinion varied about him. Sometimes the Northerners liked him, and sometimes they hated him. But once it became clear that he was not going to go along with Reconstruction, they uniformly hated him. So he didn't really, that's why he couldn't get a nomination after, you know, after, well, certainly after the impeachment, nobody wanted to have him back. But he really didn't have very much support. He spent most of his presidency trying to build that by, you know, currying favor with the Southerners and then, you know, sometimes appearing lenient to Northerners, but it didn't work. He pleased nobody. He tried to be everything to all people and ended up no place until, you know, he manages at the end to get back to the Senate for a brief period of time. But he was not, he was, it's interesting because he must have been, he was a good politician to a degree because he couldn't have come from nowhere to where he went. But once he got into office, it was like he was out of, I think, out of his league. He was out of his depth. So he ended up not very many friends at all.
About four rows back in the middle. While we're getting the mic there, do you think he was a tragic figure?
Do that? I think he was a tragic figure? Gosh. I think he was a tragedy for the country. Was a tragic figure. You know, this is... I can't find anything about him that he didn't seem to have had a visible sense of humor in a way. There's not a lot of, yeah, I would think he's a tragic figure. I'm trying to think of, when I think of tragic, you think of like a hero. You think of somebody who's, you know, has a grand, you know, persona and is sort of brought down. But I do think, in a sense, he's tragic because he wanted desperately to rise, and he actually did rise. And it's an amazing story. I mean, you can't read until you're 19 years old, and then you're president at some point. That's the grit, the tenacity, and which served him well. That's why he was able to stay committed to the Union. I mean, a tremendous personal sacrifice. He was a courageous. He could have been killed. There are people, many, many people, who wanted to kill him. And he stood fast against all of that. But I think, I don't know how much self-awareness he had. See, that's the reason I'm hesitating about this. If you think of a tragic figure, tragic figures, you have some evidence that they have some awareness of the tragedy. I think he died thinking he was vindicated and he had done the right thing. And so he wouldn't have seen, I mean, he was certainly upset about the impeachment and his failure to make it and to get the nomination again. But I think he would have thought he was successful because he was. I mean, he really did save his region from being transformed. This wasn't transformed into 1965, really. So he actually could count himself a success in a way for a very, very long period of time. Looking at him, I think, you know, if he had been a real statesman and if he had, you know, he didn't have to do everything the radical Republicans wanted, but he could have been a great president. You know, if he had made the right choices. I'll give you an example. This, I think, is very telling about him. At one point in his early career, there was a proposal to bring the railroad to eastern Tennessee. And even though his constituents wanted it, he opposed the railroad because if you brought the railroad, people would get to where they're going so quickly that you wouldn't need inns and taverns. So as not to put inns and taverns out of business, you can't have the railroad. Well, that makes sense in a way. Except, you know, towns spring up along railroad routes, and people wanted to get. I mean, he walked. People had to walk places. He had no horse. When he leaves Tennessee, he walks. He has to walk 70 miles places and stuff like that. They're talking about, you know, dodging mountain lions and so forth. So you have some sense of this lack of vision, in a way, in a vision, and so. But if you don't know where you're deficient, it's hard for me to think of you as a tragic figure. And as I said, because he was successful, he actually did stave off the transformation of the South for many, many decades. So I don't think he would count himself as a tragic figure.
He's also somebody that would walk 14 miles to go to a lecture. So next time it's snowing.
In the snow.
Come. Yeah, think about that. Okay, the lady in the middle.
Yeah. You talked about his, right here.
Where are you? Oh.
You talked about his, a little bit about his family when he was young. Tell us more about his family life as he became an adult.
He had, his wife helped him, as I said, taught him to read and write. We don't really know that much about her. She was an invalid for many years and did not accompany him to the White House, did not stay with him in the White House most of the time. His daughter served as the First Lady most of the time because she was ill. He was someone who seemed consumed by work. He was out giving speeches all the time. He was running for office. He was plotting and planning. You don't get a sense that much of his family life, other than that he was married. He had three sons and a daughter. One of his sons actually ended up committing suicide. He was an alcoholic, and that was a great tragedy in his life. I talk a little bit about in the book a reference to one of the enslaved women, one of the women that he owned. There was talk that he'd had children with her. There's no proof of that. The only thing is that he buys her, and she's about 16 years old, and she has two children, you know, who she's listed in the census as black, and her children are listed as mulatto, meaning they were mixed-race kids. And people talked about that was possibly true. Some people have criticized me about mentioning that, although someone who's written a book about Andrew Johnson and his racial views talks about this, and other articles have talked about it as well. You know, I thought, you know, here's a person who was an enslaved person in his household, a young girl. I thought it was important to mention that, even as a possibility, out of deference to her and out of concern for that you paint a picture of the lives of enslaved girls at that time period, because he could have been. We don't know that he was. But I don't think, you know, when you're talking about a person who's a slave owner, you have to talk about all of the aspects of that, not just buying and selling people. So it's not we don't get a sense of, again, this is in the comparison to Jefferson, where you have lots of letters back and forth between fathers and daughters and grandchildren and all those kinds of things, and people commented on him. One thing that people did say is that he liked children quite a bit. He was good with children, and they liked him. One of the people who was the son of a person who was enslaved, that one of his slaves, said that he even would bounce black children on his knee. I mean, you know, he liked children, which is sort of interesting when you think about the rest of his life. I mean, he was able to be apparently childlike with children, but you don't get a sense of him as a warm and funny person otherwise.
We have time for one more question. We'll go to this gentleman right here.
No, Jefferson? I'm sorry.
You may not want to answer this or even respond to this, but have you ever speculated as to whether a different kind of Johnson could have succeeded in vastly rearranging events of the last half of the 19th century?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I think he could have. I mean, he wouldn't have had to go, a different kind of Johnson would not have had to go along with everything that the Republicans had wanted to do. One of the things that he did do that I talk about in the book, is that his recalcitrance gave aid and comfort to Southerners. And people said, their letters, their comments, people said, you know, we would have accepted anything. In the immediate aftermath of the war, we would have accepted anything, any terms, but he gave us hope of a white man's government. And so we knew to hold out. And so I think the role that he played, I think it's the symbolic role of the president as leader that I think was really important. If he hadn't so strenuously opposed voting rights, if he had not sabotaged efforts to bring about land reform. This is not to say that the South would have rolled over, you know, and would have. But when you have the enemy down, you know, prostrate, when you got them down, that's when you impose terms and you move forward. And numerous people said, you know, he his actions emboldened them to be recalcitrant, to pass the black codes, to be, you know, to sort of tamp down the tamp down any move for transformation. So it would not have been the land of milk and honey. The South would not have rolled over and accepted blacks as equal citizens, but it wouldn't have been as bad as it was. And, you know, that a lessening of the problem, any lessening of the oppression, I think would have made a big difference. So, yeah, I have thought about it, and I do think I think that his particular brand of presidential leadership was toxic. And it's important, I think, for us now to think about where we are, to go back. That's the importance of history, to rewind, to go back and see how this got started and where we began to go wrong and what kinds of remedies that we need to take. I think it could have been different. History is all about contingencies. And we ended up with a person who was strong enough to stand for union and understood the importance of the union, but because of his own personal character, a character issue, was unable to see through the transformation of the South, because it was against everything that he believed.
Please join me in thanking Annette Gordon-Reed.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.